Okay. I've just started this idea of using the cell phone for the recorder back about, oh, I don't know, the last year. And it's, I'm like, why didn't I do this before? Well, first of all, I didn't know that I knew how. But anyway, thank you for agreeing to doing this interview. You know, you told me a while ago about being in Miami. That kind of leads me to the question of, tell me about yourself, because I'm fascinated about how you ended up here where you are.
Okay, I guess I should tell my whole life history. Not whole life.
Well, hopefully
history.
In,
you know, that's relevant.
3 or 4 minutes or 5 minutes or so.
3 or 4 minutes.
Because I want to know how you got here. I mean, that's really what intrigues us.
How I got to North Carolina in particular, or how I got to be a devotee of Christ?
Both.
Okay, so let's do them both in one story.
You told me you had were from Miami and had been to the Bahamas, so that intrigued me.
Yeah, well, originally I'm from, I mean, obviously you can tell from my accent I'm from New York, originally. So originally my family's from New York, and for my whole life, even as far as I can remember, like going back to like 7 or 8 years old, I was looking for the purpose of life and wanted to find out what happens at the time of death and who God is and what the soul is and all that other nice stuff. So I was a very avid reader. I've read practically every major religious book and theologians and things like that in my search. And of course, that was during the 1960s, which a lot of people were searching.
I'm assuming that's when you first read the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, in 1960s. Actually, so then I went to the university, Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, and I was studying science because I thought science can answer the questions I had, studying physics in particular, nuclear physics and other types of physics. And I found was disappointed, and then I started studying philosophy and basically philosophy and religion. And I was disappointed because nobody can answer the questions that I had in very explicit form. You know, I wanted to find out who I was, where I came from, what happens at the time of death, and what does God look like? And all the priests, rabbis, ministers, mullahs, whatever, whoever I approached, no one had definitive answers because I have a scientific background. And I wanted scientific answers to those questions. Finally, in the late 1960s, I picked up the Bhagavad Gita. And this was not the Bhagavad Gita I'm studying nowadays. It was a different translation. It was the Penguin Classic Bhagavad Gita, which is done. It's a commercial production of the Bhagavad Gita. And that impressed me, but still I felt something was missing. And then I picked up a copy of the Bhagavad Gita that was published by our spiritual leader, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And that completely impressed me with its explicit knowledge about the Absolute and about reincarnation, and I was already a vegetarian for ethical reasons. I had become a vegetarian, lacto-vegetarian. And I decided to devote myself fully to the pursuit of spiritual knowledge. But I didn't want to join any religion, at least an organized religion. I wanted to be sort of eclectic in my pursuit, which was very common in those days, in the 1960s we were talking about. And so I began to practice some of the tenets that are mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, such as the regulative principles, you know, we don't take meat, fish, or eggs, no intoxication, no illicit sex, and no gambling. And I was chanting. But I still didn't want to join a society like the Hare Krishna movement or Hare Krishna Society, because it would mean giving up my independence, number one. It would mean giving up the hair, which I was very attached to. Because remember in the 1960s, we all had hair. I mean, I don't know what year you were born in, but I'm sure you were familiar with those years. And I had quite a bit of hair, you know, facial hair and hair up here. And I certainly didn't want to wear bed sheets, you know, in the public. Because, anyway, it gets very embarrassing in America. America is not really into diversity of the sort you would find, say, in Europe and Great Britain or other places. It's really, everyone has to melt and become a standard, you know, American. So, therefore, I didn't want to do it until I met my spiritual teacher, master, Srila Prabhupada, who was the one who translated this particular book. His picture is here somewhere in the beginning. This is an old version. We published a newer version. This is his picture. He came to America in 1965 from India. Actually,
is that him?
Yeah, that's him.
Okay.
And he basically had no money with him except for a few trunks of books. He came on a steamship, and which was called the Jaladuta, and it was a free passage given to him by the owner of the steamship line. And he sat down in New York City in a place called Tompkins Square Park, and he began to chant and talk about philosophy. And gradually, you know, hundreds, thousands of Americans joined him. And when I met him for the first time, he basically convinced me that my life's mission should be to teach others about the Vedic literatures. And that's how I got where I am. Now, as far as North Carolina, I actually...
Excuse me, did you meet him in New York?
No, I met him in Gainesville, Florida.
Okay.
Because at that point, my family had moved to Florida, Miami Beach. And, you know, we had a boat there, we had a plane. My father was a big businessman. He passed away about 15, 20 years ago. And so then I was living in Gainesville, Florida with some friends. And that's where I met Srila Prabhupada, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And I decided to join full-time. And
excuse me, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you to spell his name.
His name is spelled...
Or let me write it down here. Yeah, that'll be great. Okay, I'll get that before I leave. Then.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the whole title right there.
Okay.
You can do that when you...
I'll do that.
When we're finished. So, anyway... So then I began to study an intensive course of study and practice to become qualified to preach the message, you know, to share the message. Nowadays you don't say preach anymore, you say share, which is the, you know, politically correct term.
Where did you engage in these studies?
In Gainesville, Florida, and then in Texas, in Dallas, Texas after that.
Okay.
For the first few years. And then I was assigned to do work in South America. So I moved to Caracas, Venezuela.
Let me back up. How long were these studies?
Studies were about between 3 and 4 years.
Okay.
And then after I became qualified, and of course at this point we do have formal recognition and titles. At that point we were just starting, so we didn't have these formal titles that you get as far as the levels of study. But... be that as it may, so then I moved. Then I went to South America to help with our mission, start our mission in South America, and then I was stationed in Caracas, Venezuela, where I learned to speak Spanish, obviously, because nobody speaks English there. And that was learning on the job because I didn't speak a word of Spanish before.
Oh my gosh!
But that's an easy way to learn a language, you know, because I had studied French for years. And actually, I didn't speak French after studying French for years. But after 6 months of living in a country where you had to speak Spanish, I was fluent.
Wow.
So you don't really learn to speak a language when you study in the university. You only learn it when you're immersed in the language and the culture. So right now I'm trying to study Hindi and learn a little bit of Hindi. So then after that, because this leads up to North Carolina. Then after that, I helped publish and translate books into Spanish, some of our teacher's books into Spanish. And he passed away from this world in 1977. So in 1977, 78, I took sannyas, which is like the highest spiritual order that one can take. It's called the renunciate's life, where one takes a lifetime vow of not getting married, having family, or intimate association with the opposite sex, and your whole life is dedicated to preaching. And so then, after that, I moved back to the United States, went to Miami, Florida, to help run our center there. We had quite a big center. At one point, we were right in Miami Beach with a hotel. Krishnapriya would remember that. She was there at that time. And that went on for, what, 2 or 3 years, right? 2 or 3 years. And then I decided I did need to do some pioneering work, you know, because I was accustomed in South America to doing pioneering work, and Miami was a little bit too sedate for me. And so I picked a place where there was no Krishna Conscious Center, but there was also a lot of educational institutions. You asked me about North Carolina. Within this area, I think there are more PhDs and medical professionals per capita than anywhere else in the world. you know, the Research Triangle area.
Well, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, if you study the, at least at that time, I'm not sure right now if that's true, but at that time, because you have all these major hospitals, you know, Duke Medical Center, UNC Medical Center, and then New Durham, you have several hospitals. I mean, it's, and even in Greensboro on the other side, you have several hospitals. So I wanted to situate myself equidistant from all these population areas, but not in a city, but within, let's say, commuting distance or driving distance, so people could work in a city and then come out here in the country. This was much more of a country when I moved here. Yes. I mean, for example, when we first moved here, this 16 acres where our temple is on, we were able to purchase for $34,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. That's in 1982. And now, you know, it's like, well, at least 10 times the price, the same piece of
property. Did you acquire the land across the street or road at the same time?
No, that was acquired around the year, I think, 2001 or so, 2001, 2002.
And you told me earlier that this particular location is on a 16-acre tract, but that one over there is...
That's 7 acres across the
7
street.
7 acres, okay.
Well, we have, the temple is 16 acres, and then we own two plots here. This house is on one of the plots, and that's another 7.5 acres here, and then 7 acres across the street.
I see. Okay.
And then many of our members, they own houses in the area, since it's an inexpensive area to purchase houses.
We spoke when we were coming over here a little about the early days when you arrived in this area and that people were grateful you weren't Catholics.
Yeah.
And that was in response to my question. Wow. I mean, this is pretty rough walking into this part of the world.
Yeah.
Being a follower of Krishna and being in a sea of Baptists, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever feel you were discriminated against in any way?
No.
So
no.
Everybody was basically pleasant to you.
The only trouble we had, which was, you know, people would take pot shots at our mailbox.
Really?
In the beginning, there was some kids, not adults. You know, they would shoot, destroy our mailbox. I mean, nothing's happened the last 15 years here. But in the beginning, they'd come on the property, do wheelies on the property. And even one time, someone took a shot at the dome.
And they threw rods.
Threw rods, and we had to, you know, put some security equipment out and everything like that.
Kids. Oh, my gosh, wow.
But that was the kids, you know, because they saw the dome and it looked like a pumpkin, and then, you know, devil worshiper type of stuff. Like, they would think, you know, like the you know that movie Temple of Doom?
Oh, yeah.
Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. So, you know, they had this conception of something like that. I'm sure not the adults, but it was like some of the kids. But now all the kids sit at video games all day long. They don't even get out and go out of the house anymore. I mean, it's a real change in culture.
I would think it's safe to say that probably the average teenager today is far more tolerant than was the case when, even, you know, in the early 80s when you came.
Definitely. I mean, wow. You know, the kids are just very open and tolerant. I mean, because you got the internet, you know, Facebook and everything. They're ready for almost anything.
Let me ask you, there really are, I mean, when people say Hindu, I think most readers would conjure up, and they may conjure different images. Probably the Krishna movement is the one that would most come to their minds. But but the Hindu really means study, does it not? I mean, aren't there there's different kinds of Hindus, are there not?
Actually, the word Hindu is a geographical designation.
Yeah, okay, so the Brahmin movement would be from that Hindu area then, is that right?
Well, yeah, what happened is that you had the mountains, you know, the Indus Kush mountains, and they separated India from the rest of the world, at least on the western side. And so, basically, the people in Afghanistan and other places used to call the people who lived in India, Sindhus, Indus River. Sindhus, and that later became, because they couldn't pronounce the S so well, later became transformed into Hindus. So it was like everybody who lived on that side of the Indus River became a Hindu. When you say Hindu, it doesn't really, to me, it doesn't mean anything. It could mean like Jain, Sikh, you know, impersonalist, someone who doesn't, an atheist, or just a philosopher, or someone who believes in Lord Shiva, you know, or a demigod. It can mean any one of, let's say, a million different things. Or tantric, I don't know if you know what a tantric is, but you know, people who do black magic. You know, it can mean any one of a different thing. So what we're teaching is not really Hinduism, although sometimes we use that designation because people wouldn't understand anything else. It's called Sanatan, the technical name in Sanskrit is called Sanatan Dharma, which means eternal religious principles that apply to everyone. In other words, we don't ask people to convert from one religion to another. If someone takes up our practices, they can remain a Muslim, they can remain Jew, Christian, whatever, because it's we call it the science of the soul. So it's not, I don't consider it, and it's not considered as a sectarian belief system.
There, as I recall from what little I know about this, when the Axial Age occurred was when the kind of the beginning of the formation of the idea of one God, and that kind of all began in that what you're calling the Hindu geographical area. I mean,
Yeah. This
is where we first heard of Zoroaster, or first heard of Rama, or first heard of...
Yeah, the monotheism actually started in, you know, the India area, in the area of India.
Many Americans, I think, if someone says Hindu, again, I know I'm using this term, they may think of somebody who is a follower of Hare Krishna who they saw in the airport wearing the orange robes. I was in Thailand, and I was in a temple that was dedicated to Shiva, and so there was kind of a Buddhist group that followed Shiva. It was a kind of an interesting thing. So, do you find when you talk to people around here that they have preconceived notions about what it means if someone says Hindu? Or are they thinking Krishna at the time, or do you?
Well, they don't really know. I mean, it depends on who you're talking about. Like, if they've studied at the university, they generally think Hindu means someone who believes in many gods.
Mm-hmm.
That's their... Because if you go into any Hindu center, I don't know if you've ever gone to a...
Oh, yeah, you see all the multi-arms and...
Yeah, you see all... Well, different altars with different figures on it, and you can't really figure out who God is.
Right.
You know, or are they all God, or is no one God? I can tell you a funny story in that regard. There was one man from England who went into a Hindu temple, and he looked at all the altars, and he pointed out one where Krishna was, and he said, that must be God. And the priest didn't even know that that was God. The priest said, how do you know? Why do you think that's God? And he said, well, every one of these other figures is doing something, they're working, but here's the person who's just playing the flute with his girlfriend, so he must...
Oh, that's good.
You understand?
I'm curious... You indicated that you had spent some time years ago studying physics. Have you sort of been keeping up a bit with what they're doing in particle physics?
Oh, yeah.
And do you believe in some respects that sort of validates this path you've chosen?
Well, especially when you get into quantum mechanics, yes.
Yeah, the boson theory and the string and
string
quasars
theory.
And all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, that really validates. And, you know, especially what Einstein talked about is, you know, strange action at a distance, you know, weird action at a distance, which is really interesting stuff. And I've actually been reading a lot about this, about how it's connected with biology, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever heard of something called cellular memories.
I have.
That they actually take, this is very interesting, they take some of the cells from someone, put them in a different room, subject the person to stress, and his cells that are in a different room actually experience that same stress.
It's astonishing. It's astonishing. That's a little bit of it goes that in that world of metaphysics where they talk about the 100th monkey.
Yeah.
You know, that point where it jumps from island to island, this consciousness stream. It's
exactly.
It's
I mean, there's some consciousness, underlying consciousness, you know, let's say cosmic consciousness or whatever you may call it.
Do you spend, when someone is fairly new to the Krishna, now is it, should I call this the Krishna movement? Is that a
Krishna movement? We like to use the word movement because that means to move forward.
Okay.
It's dynamic.
If someone is fairly new to the Krishna movement, do you begin by saying, oh gee, let me tell you about the Bhagavad Gita, or do you begin by saying, gee, let me tell you a little bit about the transmigration of the soul? Or I mean, where do you start?
It depends on who we're talking to. Like if someone is educated, then we'll start with the Bhagavad Gita. Otherwise, we have other introductory literatures, or we can explain about reincarnation. Sometimes we introduce people to Krishna consciousness utilizing past life regression. or yoga, like Krishnapriya there, she does yoga. She's an expert flow yoga person. And so, or mantra chanting, or music. There's different ways to introduce people. But ultimately, they do come to the Gita.
In the world of Buddhism, as you know, there's the wheel of life.
Yeah.
And in the Krishna movement, there's this again, transmigration of the soul. But there may well be some confusion by people who read this book as to how you begin the God realization progression, or can you do you teach that in the Krishna movement?
God realization.
Well, by that I mean, where do you stop reincarnating? Where do you end this cycle?
Yeah, we teach that. We teach that. You reach the cycle when you love God with all your soul, with all your might, as they say in church. You should love the Lord, thy God, with all thy soul and all thy might. When you come to that point of complete, causeless, unmotivated love for God, then you don't have to reincarnate. You go back to God. Or as you're saying, Christianity, heaven.
Okay. Well, then that sort of leads us then to this question. All religions, no matter what they may be in the world, come to this point, and that point is called death, and then it becomes what happens. So what does the Krishna movement speak to Sagnita about what happens when she breathes her last in her gross body?
Okay. So there's actually two material bodies that each and every one of us has. There's the gross body, which in Sanskrit is called Panchamahabhuta, which means five gross elements, earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And then there's a subtle body, which I guess in America you'd call it the astral body or ethereal body. And that's the body of desires. And then there's the soul. So there's three different things we're talking about. So when you leave your gross body, when the soul leaves the gross body, it carries the desires with it to the next gross body. So what determines your next birth is your desire and another thing called karma. Karma is like the reaction. I mean, let's talk about physics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So karma is the reaction for all the activities you've done in this life. For example, if I'm very good and I help a lot of little old ladies cross streets, then I have good karma. And I get to have a better body in the next life. So two things together. The example I sometimes give is what determines what type of car you buy. There's two things that determine what type of car. Your desire, and you know what else? The money.
Mm-hmm.
Two things. So the money is the karma, using the metaphor right now. Money is the karma, and desire is desire. So that determines what happens after you leave your body. Now, let's say in the case of Sunita, who is practicing Krishna consciousness, but she may not be like at the top level right now, right?
Yes.
Not to insult you.
No, I'm accepting.
Yeah, she may not be like at the topmost level of Krishna consciousness. However, she's made some advancement in spiritual life. You know, she's what we say, purify the heart to a certain extent, loving God, maybe 50%, maybe not quite the 100% to graduate, but the 50%. So she doesn't lose that. Whereas the material things that we acquire in this life, we lose at the time. You know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. So we lose. But spiritual progress is never lost. So in the next life, she'll get a chance to take up Krishna consciousness from that point which she left off.
Does she have any awareness during the between life state?
Sometimes, yes. Many times. But when she takes birth in the next life, she won't have conscious awareness.
Then that veil covers, in essence, what?
It'll be subconscious.
Can that yogic work that's being done, for example, allow her to penetrate that veil?
Yeah, well, that veil can be penetrated in next life or in this life to find out about past lives by hypnotic regression, or even with astrology, you can figure out to a certain extent who you were in your last life. But hypnotic regression is quite good in that respect.
There's a universal law called the law of reciprocity the law of correspondence, and it deals with that yin-yang karmic kind of description you gave. I think readers will be interested in if it's always an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, as the Jews would say, how in the world do you ever get above that karmic equalization? How do you move higher? Is it only through that work she's doing to increase her consciousness to become more godlike?
Yeah.
Is that
Well, there's two ways to deal with karma. One is you work out, you know, the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth type of stuff. And the other way is by becoming spiritually conscious, it sort of disintegrates your karma.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the quicker way. Mm-hmm. I mean, otherwise you got to work out whatever you did. And each one of us has, let's say, executed many activities in this life, both good and bad. I mean, nobody's all good, nobody's all bad. I mean, I'm sure even Hitler had some good moments.
His mama probably loved him.
Well, his Jewish grandmother probably did.
Probably.
But, you know, so we have this compilation of good and bad reactions that are waiting for us. But by performing spiritual life, particularly the chanting and glorification of God's name, then this karma becomes eradicated.
Hmm. What are you, I'm going to change the subject for a minute. What are your job duties here?
My job duties, oh, you got a few hours, so.
I need the 2-minute executive summary.
Yeah, 2-minute executive summary. The buck stops with me. That's the executive summary.
Oh, okay. Do you have a board of advisors or?
Yeah, we have a board here of advisors. You know, I'm basically still the president of the corporation. We have people with different duties.
So this is a non-profit corporation?
It's a non-profit corporation,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
We have people with different duties. They, for example, they're in charge of the worship on the altar. It's two nice ladies here. And some people are in charge of the cooking because we distribute a lot of food, sometimes a lot of free food to people. We have, as you saw in one of the cards I gave you, we have a program to distribute food to people not only here but overseas.
That's all right, yeah.
So we have a lot of charity activities going on. We have people in the building committee. I mean, it's different committees, and then we have a central committee that meets. But ultimately, you know, I'm responsible. And then also I'm responsible for a number of other temples around the United States and the world. Because we have a...
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Our movement is managed by a governing body. It's called the Governing Body Commission. And there's about, let's see, we have about 28, 30 of us right now. And we meet every year, at least twice a year or three times a year, to decide policies for the whole society.
I noticed that people bowed when you walked by. Is that expected, customary?
Not for everybody. These are disciples, usually.
Okay.
Disciples means people who I've directly taken care of as students. It's part of the etiquette in India.
Okay. Do you have a group? Well, I guess I would call them mandali. Do you have a group that circles you? That's sort of like your 10 disciples or 12 disciples? Or
I wish it was only 10 or 12. It's only like 860.
Suppose all these ladies came to you and said, "We think that place ought to be painted purple." Would that? I mean, they couldn't force you to paint it purple.
No,
you could paint it if you wanted to, right?
Tell them all to talk to their husbands. Purple is my least favorite color.
Oh, is it really? No, I was just trying to get a sense about how this works. So, really?
Actually, the temple here is not controlled specifically by people who are my disciples. It's more of a democratic thing.
Okay.
So our board of advisors, you know, they'll come in, and I'm open, you know, to any sort of suggestions. Although if I find that something's impractical, then I'll stop it.
When we were walking over, I was talking to you about your connection to the Grand Strand.
Yeah.
But this temple serves, as you indicated, both this triangle area, but also North Carolina and all of South Carolina, or the coast, or?
Well, yeah. Well, there's other temples that are close also with South Carolina. Like we have an Atlanta temple, too. It's a major temple. I mean, eventually we're going to have it. We also have a big congregation in Charlotte. And we're eventually going to have a temple there. We're working on developing a temple in Charlotte.
Oh, I see. But now, would Sunita, for example, would she be expected to, I'm going to say, transfer her membership? That's the only term I know to use. If that happened from Hillsboro to Charlotte?
No, we're an international society. So,
whomever she wants.
If one is a member, she's a member of our society. We don't have specific, I mean, we have people who live by the temple and they contribute mainly to the temple they're close to. But she's a member of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, so she'll attend services, whatever. She's considered a member of every temple.
One of the other big issues in every church, and you kind of were talking about that when you got the karma, is money. Are you paid a regular salary, or
no? I've taken a lifetime vow of poverty, which is part of the sannyas vow, and so my needs are taken care of.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Okay. So if Sunita feels generous and wants to write a check for $1 million...
That would be nice.
Well, I mean, you know.
I mean, you're her lawyer.
No, so, yeah. No, I wish she's talking in the right time. You know, Krishna is listening to
it. Yeah, Krishna's listening. So we have this new temple across the street. Yes. Yeah. So.
Well, that was kind of where I was leading.
She would make the temple room.
But she would make the check out to this corporation.
I don't have any personal bank accounts or anything.
Oh, okay. All right. And so you would ride around in whatever it is, a Chevy Vega or something, or a Honda. Okay.
Yeah.
But do you pick these things out, or is there a board that makes...
You mean as far as the car I ride around?
Yeah, I'm just using that as an
example. Well, I usually pick that out. I mean, it's...
What is the Krishna movement teach about money practices? Is Sunita expected, and I'm going to use the word tithe. I mean, every religion has a different way of viewing that.
Yeah.
How does the Krishna movement address this issue of money?
Well, we don't have a specific tithe. Some of our temples do have specific tithe programs.
Oh, okay.
But what I've seen is usually we depend on people's goodness to, and it usually ends up with more than a tithe. That, you know, people feel inspired to sponsor different things. I usually find that people feel inspired by different things that they want to pay for. Let's say we're building a new temple. So we have sponsorship. Someone wants to pay for the altar. Someone wants to pay for the chandelier in the main temple.
Well, now, if Fatima wanted to pay for the chandelier, would she get her name on the chandelier?
No, not in the chandelier.
Okay. Would she get her name on it?
No, there'd be a plaque.
There'd be a
plaque in the back of the temple. And then also we have like little walkways where people can have their names on the side of the walkways. Okay. Or they can sponsor a parking space in the new temple and things like that.
Okay.
But the name would usually be on a plaque. On a parking space, I guess you can put someone's name, you know.
I'm going to go back philosophical on you for a second.
Okay.
You said in your search back in the 60s, you had a number of questions. Who am I? Why am I here? And essentially, what's my purpose?
Who's God? Yeah.
What is the purpose, you think, of life?
The purpose of life is to learn that our real position is with God, not to try to enjoy separate from God. You know the whole thing about Adam and Eve? Adam and Eve, it was Eve who took the advice of the serpent and then disobeyed God's order not to eat from the apple, not to eat the apple. And so we've actually disobeyed. That's a metaphorical story. I think most Christians at this point will take it as a metaphorical story. Not that all of us are suffering just due to the sins of, you know, two people. I mean, I'm not going to suffer for someone else's sins. I don't go for that. I protest. But, you know, isn't it? I mean, someone says, you got to suffer for Eve's sin. I said, no way, you know, that's her problem, not mine. So, and so it means basically we disobeyed God. That's why we're here. There's a fall. We fell from the kingdom of God because we didn't want to keep him at the center. Now, the problem is when most people believe in religion, they want to go back to the kingdom of God, but they don't want God to be the center anymore. They want the kingdom of God to be like Disneyland, you know, with Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and everything like that, but without God there.
There was an old country song that said, everybody wants to get to heaven, but no one wants to die. It's kind of similar to what you're saying there, yeah.
And so in the spiritual world, you know, heaven, God is the center. Everyone talks about him, you know, and serves him. And the reason we're here is because we didn't want to do it. So we're here learning. This is like a prison. Even in Sanskrit, the word for this world, material world, you know, one word is durga, which means it's very difficult to move. And so it's like a prison where you're supposed to have some reformation. And it sometimes takes a long time for us to be reformed.
Does the Christian movement use the term Maya? Does it talk about illusion?
Maya means illusion.
Yeah, and so is that in the Christian movement used in the context that this is that this gross world in which we're living is really not? I mean, it is an illusion. It's really not real anymore.
It's real and not real simultaneously. It's real. I mean, obviously this is real. I'm not just imagining you and this couch and the phone and everything like that. But the illusion is in thinking it's permanent.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that I think that my relationship with, you know, Hillsborough, North Carolina, with this body is all permanent. That I am so-and-so. I am American, or I am white, or I am male. That's the illusion. It is a fact that I'm walking around in an American male body. But it's not a fact that this is eternal.
What does the Krishna movement teach, in light of all that you've said, about someone who's lying in a ditch, and I'm using the parable now from one of Jesus' parables, right. The Good Samaritan. Someone's lying in the ditch. What does the Krishna movement teach is the proper response to this person who's lying in the ditch, who's been beat up upon by the robbers?
Well, the proper response is to help him.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was asking that in light of the karma, because one argument is, well, that was his karma, and I've seen this in the Buddhist movement.
Yeah, yeah.
That's his karma. We just walk by and leave the poor guy there because that's the path he chose. But
well, then that's heartless, yeah. And God doesn't appreciate that. It's our duty, if we see someone in difficulty, it's our duty, you know, whether they're starving to death or lying in the ditch or whatever, to help them and also help them spiritually. Because yes, they have karma, but we also have a methodology to help them overcome that karmic entanglement, which is spiritual life.
If I knew that you were having some heavy issue with which you had to deal, I mean, maybe you just discovered you had cancer or something.
Yeah.
I would want to pray for your well-being.
Fine, yeah.
Is that what
that's what we
is that
do
what
too.
You yeah. So Sunita, Pratima, everybody in here would want to be praying for you for your well-being
yeah.
And your
yeah yeah that's that you'd pray prayer
okay.
Prayer is an important part.
And I'm not picking on some of the other Eastern religions by saying this, but there's in some of those we don't seem to get into intercessory prayer and I've kind of wondered where the problem
No, we're very similar to the Western monotheistic religions insofar as our practices.
Okay.
I mean, the actual internal practices are pretty similar. We have prayer. I mean, the external manifestations may be a little bit different.
When you speak with a Baptist or a Methodist or a Catholic and you talk about, I mean, because so many of the things you're saying is so many of the things they're saying as well.
Yeah.
Except one of the big differences, you're talking about the continuation of the soul, reincarnation, transmigration of the soul. That's not something taught in Western religion and thought. Do you see this beginning to change a bit in terms of listening at least to what you're saying?
Yeah, there's a lot of listening going on. And of course, I can cite a lot of early Christian theologians who did believe, like Origen, for example, one of the early Christian theologians, he believed in reincarnation.
Right.
And, and of course you had a lot of, Plato believed in reincarnation. He's not Christian, obviously, but, Socratic and pre-Socratic philosophers, a lot of them believed in reincarnation.
Right. And there are some sects inside the Christian movement who have that, maybe the Unity Church, for example, or those, but they're the minority, not the majority, as you well know. What would the Christian movement say about, for example, abortion, wholesale abortion going on in this country?
We're very much against abortion because it's killing a living entity. The child is there from the time of conception. And so, why should you differentiate between whether the child's inside or outside? The child, it's a living entity. I mean, it's a human being.
Mm-hmm.
We're very much against abortion, although we don't picket abortion clinics or set bombs or anything like that. That's a little crazy. We try to change people's consciousness. The whole idea is to help people develop compassion rather than be simply, psychopaths with no empathy for people. And compassion begins not only with other human beings, but with animals, too. That's one reason why we're vegetarians.
Does the vegetarian extend to fish as well?
Yes.
Okay. All right. What about dairy products?
That's an interesting question because we were talking about that this morning. Because all dairy products in America, other than those that may come from a non-violent farm, are products of violence. Because what they do is after they milk the cow doesn't give enough milk, they turn it into hamburgers, they take the calves away, slaughter the calves, turn them into veal.
Right.
So because of that, I personally am vegan, which means no milk products. Because I cannot stomach causing harm, even indirectly, to a cow or a calf. But most of our members are not. Most of our members take milk products. And we were enjoined by our founder to start farms where we would raise the cows and not slaughter them.
Wow. You listed earlier the vows that you took, and I didn't hear you say it, maybe you did say it, but is it one of the Christian movement teachings that you should not imbibe in alcoholic beverages right. as well?
Or smoke cigarettes, or drink coffee, or tea.
Anything
that changes or affects the consciousness.
Okay.
Something like the Baptists originally.
Well, yes. I'm listening to that with great interest.
Obviously, no smoking, no coffee, tea, cigarettes.
Yeah, the Pentecostal holiness actually would be even closer
to that.
Yeah,
we're pretty close to that.
That's really interesting.
And sometimes we even have heated discussions about chocolate.
Yeah, I'm probably guilty on that one.
I also take chocolate's not that bad. But.
What's the most satisfying aspect of your calling?
Helping people, bringing people closer to God. That's the most satisfying thing.
And what's the most difficult aspect of your job?
The most difficult aspect is when you try to help people and you're really their well-wisher and they turn against you. Biting the hand that feeds you.
I know this one's going to be really difficult for you to answer briefly, but unfortunately we're just about out of time. And I went by it without realizing that I'd done that. How do you describe God?
God is the most attractive person in that he is the most famous, most powerful, most knowing, most renounced, most beautiful, most intelligent person.
You use the word he. Is there a particular reason why you use the word he?
Yeah. Well, actually, to be real precise, there is a feminine and masculine aspect of the Absolute. That's Radha. Like we say, Hare Krishna, Hare, the word Hare refers to the feminine aspect, and Krishna refers to the male aspect. But generally, the word Krishna, the male aspect, is taken as God, and the female aspect is taken as his primary energy. I don't know if I'm getting too...
No,
maybe with the philosophy. And so we do say that, not that God is both male and female, but God, the absolute truth, has a male and female aspect. There is God, who is male, the supreme male, and there's the supreme female, which is Radha, or Hare, as we say in the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. And that's the absolute description of the absolute truth. So therefore, you know, we're not chauvinistic.
Is there anything else you would like me to be sure that gets in this written?
There's a lot more,
summary.
But how much time do you got?
Well, you know, anything else you can think of that you think might be of interest that I could put in this article that I'm going to...
Well, the main thing is that we're not sectarian, that anyone can take up Krishna consciousness and remain in their own religion. I have people who are Muslims. I have one person in a Muslim country who's practicing Krishna. Of course, he can't let anyone know or else... And I can't even tell you what country, or else I'd get him in trouble. And we have a Catholic monk. I mean, I have a book. Do you have any copies of that book that I published, Anita? The Encounters book? That would be a good book for him to read. Because I published one book, it's a very small book, based on discussions I've had with Catholic monks about the principles of Krishna consciousness. And one Catholic monk is actually practicing, and he's in a Benedictine monastery right now.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you. And I guess I ended with Hare Krishna.
Can't thank stay you any longer? I guess you got to run or something.
Well, I'm with my co-pilot here.
Co-pilot is... Harshad wanted us to go to Raleigh.
Oh, you're going to go to Raleigh,
but
too?
But no, we are not.
Oh, you're not.
Because he says I don't want to go in a dark...
I don't like to fly after dark.
He doesn't like to fly in the dark, so we will.
You're only flying VFR, right?
No, I came over here on instruments because of
instruments.
The. Yeah, I flew through We flew through some rain and clouds and fog and stuff. And
so you're rated for instruments.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's I have a commercial rating as well.
Oh.
Yeah, when I started flying, which was actually 7 years ago this month, I thought. Well, first I thought I'll just see if I can solo. Well, then that led to, I've come this far, why don't I just see if I can get the private license? And then I realized when I got the private that I didn't know enough. It just wasn't safe for me to be, I didn't think, without an instrument rating. So I went down that road, and then I thought, wow, I need to know a little more about flying. So that then I went to Commercial Road. I'm done now. But I just didn't want the responsibility for people in the plane with being with me and having not spent some considerable time studying all this stuff. So that's kind of how I got there.
And your health is good, obviously.
Oh yeah,
because you have to take a medical exam for a commercial
every year.
Every year, yeah.
Yeah. That is kind of nice because every year at least I go find out if my heart's still working. And then although Sunita probably has time, she thinks my heart's not working. But
I wouldn't want her to land the plane, you know.
No. Actually, Pratima called me last night and said, "Be prepared. You will be sick on the plane." I said, "Okay."
Couldn't believe she said that.
We were just riding, and I said, "Okay, it was pretty good. Nothing was obstructing my body." So I said,
"I haven't told her the wind's going to pick up this afternoon."
What sort of wind? Do you have a tailwind coming here?
Or? Well, it was a west wind, so it shifted a little around Fayetteville and slowed me down a bit. But this plane normally averages, when I file flight plans, I file at 140 miles an hour, and that's pretty typically what I do. But today we were slowed down a little bit by a little headwind. Mm. Wasn't much, but a little. Going back, we'll have a slight, because it's all a west wind, there's a front coming through.
Yeah.
But we'll pick up winds this afternoon. It's supposed to get up to 20 knot winds, but they're west winds in this air. Both where we came from, the runway is east west. So
you're all right.
I'm fine. This one in Chapel Hill is east west.
Oh, you landed in Chapel Hill.
So it all worked out great. The only thing about Chapel Hill, I was going to tell you. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
They have these strange rules at Chapel Hill. If you land on this runway 27, which is facing to the west, you're supposed to go on with the runway. You're supposed to go over the airport and fly down with the runway on your right side. It's a right approach. Mm. And I assume there must be housing on the other side that's very noise sensitive.
Yeah.
And then they have this rule that says you're supposed to remain at 2,000 feet on your downwind. Well, my goodness, the airport is about 450 feet, and I'm thinking, 2,000? Where are you supposed to lose this altitude?
Yeah,
so, yeah, I did one of these kind of deals, and I was worried about her, you know, because she's not used to that. But she seemed to be fine.
Not knowing nothing, it's better.
And then I did one of these kind of deals to land, and, you know, but
you are scared.
She seemed to be all right.
He was going that way. Said,
there's a lot of noise ordinances there.
I figure that must be it, the people who are just, and I thought, well, golly, this airport's been here a long time, I'm sure, and
but it's old.
It's an old airport.
It's an old airport, but the developments around the airport are newer.
Oh, I see. I want to get a picture of. Well, first of all, I want to get a picture of this. Let's see. And then I want to get this picture, if I may.
You can always pick these pictures up on the internet, too.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
You get a much better quality than shooting through the
glass. Oh, okay. Well, then I will do that.
If you just go to my website, there's all sorts of pictures there.
Okay, great. That's exactly what I'll do.
I didn't write my website address on the card.
Oh, please.
Wherever that card is. Or I can give you another piece of paper.
Did I write
the website? No, I didn't.
One thing that was interesting when you were talking about the reactions of Baptists in the area. A number of years ago, many years ago, one of our members had met a Baptist professor who at that time was with Wake Forest and now he's with Campbell. So over the years, we've had very wonderful dialogues with Baptist professor who would bring all of his students who were becoming ministers in the area to the temple. So many Baptist ministers have come to our temple. And then even over the years with Goswami travels a lot, but myself and Golokananda, they'll have us for lunch. They make sure there's something vegetarian.
Oh, nice.
And so we've developed over the years actually very nice rapport with many of the different Baptist ministers. We had one lady who had come and spent time with us. So there's been, since we've been in the area a long time, we developed many nice relationships with people, had intelligent discussions and working towards deeper understanding of different traditions.
That is terrific. You know, I meant to ask, and I completely forgot. What are the marks on
this? This is called Tilak. It marks our body as a temple of God. We put that on every morning when we bathe.
I see.
Just like this and this, like that.
And as a visual reminder, is that?
Yeah, it reminds us, like marking the body.
Yeah.
Cool. Like a tattoo.
Cool.
You have to ask Krishna Priya Mataji how she got into the...
Why don't I take all of your time? How did I get... I was a student of psychology. I graduated from the University of Florida in psychology. And at that time, I could see that modern psychology wasn't answering a lot of the questions that I had about life, why people were suffering so much.